Hello? We will start the next section. I've been asked to introduce the two next elements. It's about the NUMA project, and first we will see 2 or 3 minutes of a film from the NUMA project, and then I will introduce the next speaker afterwards. Yep. Okay?
Faces great challenges in areas such as development and education.
The biggest challenges for the educational system, I would say, is perhaps the access, the expenses, the financial situation in general. Poverty is definitely not helping with having better quality education, let's say. School fees are high. Not all students have those fees. In general, education should be a free education for all. In theory, it is. But there's always registration fees, there's examination fees, there's these little fees that the parents cannot always provide. And that would sometimes be a reason for students to stay at home.
At a research conference in Omdurman, just outside the capital Khartoum, teachers and students from Sudan, South Sudan, Zambia, South Africa, and Norway were gathered to discuss topics related to international education and development through the NUGU and the NUMA project.
Well, the NUMA project is a master program in international education and development between the University of Cape Town in South Africa, University of Zambia in Zambia, Afad University for Women in Khartoum, Sudan, and Oslo University College. And this program is financed by NURAD and is focusing on education and HIV/AIDS. The NUCIP project is a program also in international education and development, but there are only two partners in that program, South Sudanese University and Oslo University College.
The major goal of the project is the capacity building for candidates and students to be competent to work in the sector, the private and public sector of education and development. Through this program, the NUMA program and this master, they will acquire the skills necessary and also the attitudes and knowledge necessary for working in these sectors of development and education, as education is the key for development.
Turn on the light, maybe. Hello? Yeah, I recommend you to see the whole film. It's on a DVD and tells the whole story. It's not. Can you not hear me? Hello? Yeah. So the next speaker has come a long way, and he has waited also very long today to be able to speak. I don't know if I should apologize for that, but that's the best is usually the last, huh? So I'm now welcoming Professor Austin Chieka, professor of religion and education at the University of Zambia in Lusaka. And Austin is also here because he's a good friend,
yeah,
and a good colleague. And he was the main actor in the NUMA program from Zambia. And we edited and wrote a book together that came out last year, or 2015, on HIV and education in Sub-Saharan Africa or something like that. So it's a pleasure to welcome you to Norway and to this conference, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, congratulations on this occasion of 20 years anniversary. I'm going to use some gadget here. I'm not too sure. Okay. Okay. So that's sort of the title of what I'm going to present. Basically, it's the NUMA program from the perspective of the Zambian context. And it's some background to the story I'm going to tell. Is that like all universities in the world, our university, University of Zambia, UNZA, has this vision and mission to be the center of excellence in the region, center of excellence in the country, and to be the leading university in the area of research, teaching, and community service. And this university was founded in 1966, and this has been the mission and vision. But there's this interesting part. Between 2008 and 2012, there was this strategic plan. And I was there at the university at that time, but what struck me was this. There was this restoring of excellence in teaching, research, and public service, which was an indication that something had disastrously gone wrong in the university. I think we had lost it somehow. And yesterday, over dinner, Andash and Bob asked me, is your university basically a teaching university or research and all that? And my answer was that I think there was a time we lost it, and we've simply been teaching, not researching. So there was this. And why I'm projecting this, it's because it's between those years that the NUMA program came in. And it was kind of really a rescue for us in some ways. So the vision and the mission statement was problematic to realize. I'm going backwards. And then enter NUMA. Right. So Oslo University College in those days had done an application to NORAD, and they were given funding for this new master's program. And Afad University for Women in Sudan was the main partner in Global South with Oslo University College, and UNZA and Cape Town University were the sort of minor partners from the Global South. So we went into this partnership, and from Sudan, We worked out the program in 2006, and in 2007 we met in Lusaka again to finalize the whole program. So between 2006 and 2007, faculties from the four cooperating universities had the what we call the NOMA Masters in International Education up and running. And 2007, we sent Zambia sent four candidates, and those are their names. I think Joseph Chita we saw earlier, and Kabanda was already in Norway. He's somewhere here. He's already a PhD candidate, and there was this lady Heather, who is also a PhD candidate already, and Sister Trinity. And in 2008, we had three candidates coming from Zambia, and in 2009, we had five. This was a very big contingent from Zambia. And in 2010, we had another five, a very big contingent. But we've had other Zambians coming to the MIA program. So in total, Zambia benefited about 30 or more individuals came to Norway for MIA or the NOMA programs. And I just want a little bit to say a little bit about the status of some of these graduates. Joseph from the first group is at the University of Zambia in my department. And then Heather is in the Ministry of Education minding the UNESCO DESC program, and she's also a PhD candidate. Now, they are PhD candidates in a localized NOMA, as we call it, the Master of Education in Education and Development, which we came up with after the NOMA had run its course. And then we have these others who are high school teachers, but they have proved their worth, and they are either heads of departments or they are given high responsibilities wherever they are. And some of them are in colleges of education as lecturers. There's this lady, Lydia. She's a university lecturer as well and a PhD candidate. And then others in high school as lecturers. That's just a picture of the first cohort and the second cohort. Kabanda must be somewhere here. Do you identify yourself? Okay. And Anne, are you? Yes. Still some status of these students. The 2010 group, this lady, Christine, is a staff development fellow at UNSA. Now, this is the biggest group we had. We had five Zambians here. And we had two Sudanese. This is Yasmin, who was talking in the short film we saw. This is Sudanese, Hassan, Yasmin. And then we had two Norwegians, Lieve, I think, and Christine. And the rest were Zambians. And this was a very privileged group, I would say, because they were able to be under the teaching of Professor Michael Kelly, one of the leading scholars in Zambia. Something more. I think I should go back to the impact. So we localized the NOMA Masters Yes. We localized the NOMA Masters. We called it Master of Education in Education and Development. The university could not allow us to call it Master of Education and Development as such. They said no. This program is housed in the School of Education, so it must be Master of Education, and whatever you want to call it, you must put it in brackets as Education and Development. So we followed that to the letter. So the first cohort, we had five of them. There were actually eight. Three could not make it because of problems with leave or at work. So we had five, that was the first group. And second group, we had 12. And it had become very, very popular, this. And then two of the 12, second group, two went to Finland for summer exchange, which was very good for them. Then the third cohort, we had 10. And currently we have three doing PhD by research only. Now I want to come to the impact of the NOMA program on our university as an institution and perhaps on individuals that were involved or that profited from this. Of course, some of us were able to come to Norway, to go to Cape Town, to Sudan, to see how friends were teaching and to kind of exchange ideas and learn from one another. That was appreciated. There was capacity building in each one of us. We learnt from Norwegian scholars, and we learnt from Sudanese scholars and from South African scholars. And believe you me, because of this, the NOMA program, the University of Zambia created an international link office, which never existed before. Because when our students came from Norway, for instance, we bothered them. We bothered the administration. We went up to the vice chancellor, for instance, asking, where are you going to accommodate these students? Oh, we don't know. Can you try to look around? Because we cannot accommodate them in our filthy halls of residence on campus. So as a result, an international link office was created. So that was one achievement. Okay, just some picture of capacity building. I think this I've said already. There was more. The interdisciplinary nature of the project contributed to the professional development of staff by exposing them to varied knowledge in the field of education. Especially Zambians, I think we appreciated that. When we came to Norway, for instance, we saw how education was mixed with development studies, with other areas, academic disciplines, and that helped us a lot. The master's program overall has supplied qualified academic staff to higher education institutions in the country. As you saw, some of those graduates from here, from this program, have gone to teach in colleges of education. That's a huge impact. And so activities such as curriculum development, collaborative teaching, joint supervision, and exposure to new disciplines supported and enhanced academic capacity at UNSA. I think we learned a lot of how to go about coming up with a new program, how to do course outlines and things like that. And From the NOMA program, our university is going credit system, and it was as a result of our NOMA program. They always asked us, what is this 10 credits, 20 credits? Why are your students going to Norway coming back with these 20? We tried to explain, and they got it, and they're trying to do that. So through the process of localization, a spirit of cooperation between schools and departments has been developed. So there's now these synergies in the university. We had problems to come up with courses from the School of Education only. So we went to the School of Humanities and other schools to see what courses they were running so that we could bring them on board and our students could attend different courses in the university. Earlier, they were all closed. You go to gender studies, they said, no, School of Education, because at the University of Zambia, School of Education is always perceived as a school full of those who could not make it to law, medicine, and so all the failures went to the School of Education. So there was that. But we broke that barrier. And so we invite people to come and teach on our program, and they are very happy. And then in 2012, students presented papers at a conference at Afar University for Women in Sudan, and there was a joint graduation. I think we saw that picture that Christine showed. And the conference ended with a graduation ceremony that we saw. Then the process of selecting the best papers and with a view to publishing a book started. So from 2013 to 2014, we worked on this. And it was a good learning point for us. And Anders was the lead here, and we really appreciated what he did. And in 2015, there was the book launch in Lusaka, and Anders was around, and this is the book. And that's our journey. That's all it ended. But it had started the whole... The project started in Sudan. The camel was reluctant to take off. But with Anders, he couldn't stay on the ground, took off. And when we ask students even today, what did you appreciate about the NOMA program? One thing that really pops up on everybody's lips is the multicultural experience. And that is very important to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments to Austin's presentation? I have a question myself, if I may. The program that you have developed based on the NOMA program, how have you worked to adapt that to your the needs of your and the possibilities of your institution, the needs of your students?
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more or a little bit about that?
Okay, so what we have is, in that program, we have about six courses. They're mostly in the area of education and development. There is a course on that, HIV and AIDS and gender issues, because that's still a problem in our country. Then we have foreign debt and a course on foreign debt and all that. And then there is a course on corruption and issues of issues of corruption and issues of unaccountability and things like that. I can't remember exactly the nomenclatures of the courses, but we've really taken the societal issues on board in our courses. Yeah. And debt also is one of the courses, I think. So depending on the availabilities of faculties at a given time, students choose these courses.
I think it's very interesting to hear those developments. Yeah. And as you may have heard, we're about to develop our master's programs now also in different directions. And we just heard a very interesting presentation on Friday on teaching online, or, you know, doing joint teaching. I don't have the vocabulary for this, Ellen, because this is your project. But what Ellen has been doing in Nepal with, using teaching over the internet and involving people in lectures in between Nepal and Norway. And I think that was so inspiring. It was so fascinating. And I'm thinking now, listening to what you were telling us about the developments that you are doing in this course, in Lusaka, maybe this would open some opportunities for us to take this collaboration, further, and to have your lectures teach our students over the internet. How about that, Ellen? What do you say? I was told on Friday that the technology is there. And we should maybe, this is just from off the top of my head, but it's inspiring now that you have develop the program and it's operational in Zambia, that we could also benefit from these later developments that you have created based on the initial collaboration.
Yeah.
So
that would be great.
Maybe that's something to think about.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. Are there any other questions or comments?
Let me just point out thing. Yeah. One thing. Yeah. About now that you talk about internet. Uh-huh. Connectivity at the University of Zambia, I think Anne, you'll agree with me, was a big challenge.
Yeah.
With the normal students around, we kept on pushing the center, that is called the CICT, I don't know what it means. We kept on asking them, our students cannot access internet, and they can only access internet when they're around, because when they go back to the boarding houses we have for them, there's nothing there. And our vice chancellor worked extremely hard, and now connectivity is excellent, which as a result of Anne's group, for instance. Yeah.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, then maybe that opens some more opportunities.
Yeah. Now, it's not a question, but just a piece of information. I think it's very exciting for us also that the master course has been adapted to the Zambian context. Mm-hmm. And the same has happened actually in Khartoum. There is now also a master course in international education development at Afad University of Women. And we are now in Ethiopia, as you have heard about, and now they are planning and they will establish a similar master course at Hawassa University in Ethiopia as well. So, I mean, we are colonizing the whole of Africa.
Oh, sure.
No, I think colonizing is the wrong term. It's brailleization. Just quickly, Austin, you were saying that, if I understood you correctly, that the status of the School of Education improved because of these links with Norma. You were offering these master's degrees. I think it's common in African universities that the School of Education is a poor relation. Can you say a bit more about what actually happened and why people began to look at you with a bit more respect when you'd got the master's there?
Yeah. So what happened was, first of all, the NOMA program before localization, there was a little bit of an incentive for those who came to teach. Now, when these students came back to their respective countries, we had to offer them a module. And sometimes the school did not have the expertise, so we had to invite two colleagues from humanities or economics to come and teach. And then when we gave them a little money, like $50, for instance, they said, oh. They went all over to talk about the School of Education, what they are doing. You know, they have this partnership, and it's working out well. Let's support them. And then deans bought into that, and so they began to respect us a great deal, a lot more than they did before. And then when we presented our program, they were really fascinated by what we did. How could you possibly get some courses? How did you manage to get courses from other schools? This is incredible. This is the way to go. So we got some respect. We began to receive respect because of these synergies we were creating. And now we thought that after localization, everybody would stop because there was no incentive. No, it's not the case. They keep on coming. And of course, for their own CV, they keep on coming. Can I teach something? Yeah.
This collaboration was between the University of Cape Town, Zambia, AFAD, and Oslo. And for the University of Cape Town in South Africa, it was the first time ever that they had collaborated with universities in Africa. They only collaborated with the US, the UK, and so on. So this was a major, actually, achievement. First time collaborating with other universities on the same continent. I mean, it's stunning.
Because the campus space is south.
Hmm? Yeah, maybe.
They look out on the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments? I would just like to say one final thing. Your students, we miss them very much. The students from UNSA contributed enormously to our teaching and learning activities here at the college. And it's from my heart, I really miss them.
Yeah.
And they were very well prepared, excellent students, top of their class. It was a wonderful experience, and hoping that there may be ways to continue that.
I think also this college has done a great deal to them. Just to give you one example of Morgan, I think one student applied to go and work in Sudan as a peacekeeper because he was a policeman. And just in his CV, the fact that he was on this program and had done a module in Sudan, that automatically helped him get into South Sudan as a peacekeeper. And he's very happy getting lots of money from the United Nations.
Austin, I want to give you a symbolic thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
From the college. Okay, we will take a couple of minutes to get ready for the final element of today's seminar, a round table, which is going to be led by Maren. Jeg skal gå ut nå, så sjekk.
Yes. Hello, hello. Very warm welcome to today's last official section session. There have been people here who have really wanting to speak about the Sustainable Development Goals, but haven't really. So I'm happy to announce that this is the time of the day where we will. And we have a wonderful panel with us. Thank you for making time for us and being here at this hour. We should have a fourth participant, Anne-Marie Helland from Norwegian's Church Aid, and she regrets that she can't come, and that's very sad for us. But the good thing is that we can learn more from you who are here. We have Olav Seim from NORAD. He is the policy director at the education section NORAD, and before he had this position, he was the policy director for education at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And as we've heard earlier today, he has also been involved with UNESCO for a long while and other organizations. And then we have, and I'll make sure to pronounce this correctly, we have Kjetil Fass from Redd Barna, Save the Children Norway. And she has been, she is a senior advisor for education and humanitarian crises. And she has been working for Redd Barna since 2011. And I just learned that you've come back from South Sudan last week, and we probably will hear more about that. And we've had the pleasure to hear you talk this morning, Bob. So just to mention for you who haven't been there this morning, Bob has been working in and for universities in the UK, in Southern African countries, and also here in Oslo. And he's been involved and is still involved in reporting and producing reports and studies for NORAD, UNESCO, UNICEF, the World Bank, and many other organizations. Bob, earlier today you've all encouraged us to generate questions and then hopefully answer some of them. So I've generated a couple of questions for you, and I hope that you can maybe help us unpack what we're wondering about here regarding the new development goals. And especially we're going to focus on the goal for ensure inclusive and equitable quality education and promoting lifelong learning and opportunity for all. That's the new sustainable education goal. And my first question for you in the panel is, well, what's new about this goal? Are they different from the NDGs, or is it actually just more of what we know just under a different label? And maybe, Kjetil, I don't know if you... Would you like to start?
Yes. So, first of all, happy anniversary. And thank you for inviting Save the Children to be on this panel. When some of you were saying, when did I first learn about this master's program, then I was thinking, when did I learn about this master's program? I'm not a student of this institution or a graduate, but I actually worked with one of your graduates in South Sudan when I was an advisor in the Ministry of Education. I had the pleasure of working with George Ali. Some of you may know him. He is now a director the Office of Development Partners Cooperation, so a very good representative of this institution. Maren, before I answer your question, as Save the Children, I think we need to also listen to what the children say. And since I was told no PowerPoint, I brought you a picture of Adieu. Maybe, Olav, maybe you could help me. This is Adieu. I met Adieu in Rumbek, in Western Lake State, last week. And then I asked her, she's 14 years old, and she's a first-year student in an accelerated learning program, which means a condensed primary school program. And then I asked her, so Adia, why are you in school? And she said, as you know, in South Sudan, many are pastoralists. They live with their cattle. And she came from a cattle camp. And she was saying, there's only trouble, conflict, no future for me there. And her aunt had helped her and discussed for 1 year with her family before she was allowed to leave the cattle camp and come and stay in town and go to school. Her aunt does not know how to read or write, but her uncle does. And I think the aunts like this and girls like this is what really keeps us in Save the Children going. So for your question, and what you were saying, Professor Breili, there is a learning crisis in the world, no doubt about it. And the World Bank just released a report on education, and it's the first report on education ever. And those of you who are students here, this is your homework for tomorrow. And we know that when the bank talks, the finance people talk, listen. So this is good news for us. But I still haven't answered your question. So what is different with the SDGs? So yes, they are different. They're absolutely. The question is yes, and so they are much clearer on inclusion. Inclusive learning. They are also much clearer on reaching the most marginalized. And the inequity perspective is something that Save the Children has been championing for years. So there are three main differences. So the first difference from the MDG to the SDG, as the MDGs were on primary education, primary school and access, while the SDGs go from pre-primary and is lifelong learning. Number two is that there's a shift from access to quality, So regarding access, so the world has made huge progress in getting children into school. There's been all the UNICEF, you were saying you had learned about the UN when you were in Malakal. So UNICEF has had back to school campaigns all over the place. Say the children started early to talk about quality. So I'd like you to direct you to a very good report that we have produced called Hidden Exclusion. And so because it's about all the children that are in school but not learning. So when a child is out of school, it's an obvious injustice, an exclusion. But millions more in-school children suffer because they are not given the opportunity to learn. There are 130 million children in school who are not learning. And this, we heard Professor Breili talk about this. They are not learning even the basics. And it's a shocking figure. And it's masked by the focus of the recent decades of getting children into school. So the focus needs to be on ensuring that no child is excluded, but that every child, including the poorest and most disadvantaged, they're both in school but also learning. So that was two. And I think I have one more. I said three. So there's a stronger focus on inclusion. So what do we mean by inclusion? So what do you think when I say inclusion? So I'll give you the answer. ultra poor, ethnic minorities, marginalized, children like Adieu are living in conflict countries, children with disabilities. So and also the SDGs, they have a null vision. It's a zero vision. Can I say this? Zero sure. Vision? Okay, yeah, yeah. I think maybe this is my fourth point. I'm not sure. So, but the SDGs, we're not talking about reducing poverty. We are talking about eradicating poverty. Thank you.
Right. Olaf, Sam, do you also think the answer is yes? And if so, why and how?
Yes, thank you for the invitation. And first of all, congratulations to the faculty and the program, master program, on its 20th anniversary. I was never privileged to be a student because I was too old, but I feel almost as a student because I was quite a frequent visitor here because we had a very, constructive collaboration with Linz at that time, and our big leader, Bob, was sort of heading a reference group, which created, in intellectual terms and not physical terms. Just getting back to the sort of exchange I had with Professor Bailey recently, I got back a sort of the feeling of déjà vu, because we used to have a annual conference with the World Bank, and we sort of tried to hold the bank accountable for various issues, including quality. And there was one participant who always showed up. That was Professor Bock-Uttner. And she always emphasized the importance of mother of instruction. And she's been proved correct, of course. This is something that is now common, sort of consensus, that if you don't provide sort of basic instruction in the, I don't think it's called mother tongue anymore because that can discriminate someone. I think it's called something, language of your home or something. It's very complicated, home language. But I was really intrigued to be part of the presentation of the World Development Report 2 weeks in which we had in NORAD, which was all about the fundamental importance of basic skills, particularly skills in literacy and numeracy. If you don't obtain these skills, you will be excluded. So I think maybe we had some impact on the World Bank. At least it's now common understanding that without this basic skill, but this is where some of the countries also have huge challenges. For instance, Ethiopia, I think, have 70 different languages. How do you cope with these issues? It's enormous. But getting back to your question, I think it's not a question of new wine in old bottles. There are some fundamental changes with the SDGs compared to the MDGs. And I think I got a bit provoked because you also have to distinguish between the EFA goals and the MDG goals. And I think there was nothing wrong with the EFA goals. They were very progressive. The problem was when you introduced the MDGs, which focused on two goals, which was access and gender parity. This meant all that focus was on access. And the sort of international leaders focused on getting as many children as possible in school, not realizing that getting 80, 100 pupils in one class would have an impact on learning. And it was not until the Global Monitoring Report in 2013 came up with the shocking figures that I think 250 million fourth graders didn't read or write, and half of them had been in school. That really was an eye-opener for the international community. But I think what is different with the SDG is the sort of its universal progressive. It has to include everybody. It's not the big issue now is sort of how to ensure that no one is left behind. The MDGs were focusing on percentages to achieve so-and-so. For instance, there was in the EFA goal, one of us on literacy, which said that 50% of adults, we should have an increase in 50%. Now it's absolute. And I must say I have a strong ownership to SDG 4 because I was in UNESCO at that time and we were co-leading with UNICEF this the World We Want process, taking lessons from the MDGs, and we had a big consultation all over the world, and particularly thanks to a massive mobilization for civil society, education came up as the number one sector in terms of being prioritized as important for the new goals. But it's taken some time really to reverse this trend from access to quality. And I must say I learned quite a lot when I was a student at Linz, particularly the importance of teachers. If you don't do anything about the quality of teachers, you will be lost. I can come back to this, but as far as I can see, my concern is that the SDGs are extremely ambitious. For instance, SDG 4 has, I think, seven targets and three means of implementations. And now even Norway is not succeeding in terms of reaching SDG 4 because now it includes free education from 1 year of preschool to upper secondary education, which very few countries are in a position to. So here you're facing this dilemma of being, should the goals be aspirational or should they inform the national debate? And I think the critical issue is how this is sorted out at the national level, because this sort of progressive word means a lot. It means that you're not supposed to do that immediately. It has to be seen in the context of the national development. And for me, the critical issue is what goals are set at the country level, what sort of accountability is established with regard to monitoring and achieving the goals.
Thank you. Should we lead over to Bob?
Yeah, in fact, Olaf has stolen some of my text, especially this aspirational issue. Because the way I see this, the goals are different. They are better, whatever that word may mean. They do represent aspirations unless you can turn them into reality. What I was talking about this morning, I was saying that a policy is not a policy if you can't believe you can actually implement it and act upon it and see it working. It becomes a slogan and nothing more than that. And I was talking to one of the current master's students in the break that how do you turn this aspirational thing into an operational thing where you actually get change and you get something going. And while I was here on the staff in this institution, and incidentally the lady who's missing, Anne-Marie Heller, was a student here as well. So to be a student here means that the stars are only part of the limitation. But and she also came to us in Bristol to do a master's degree there, along with various other people who've worked with Olaf in foreign affairs and whatnot. Anyway, where was I? Yes. Yes, I'm sorry he sold out and went to the World Bank. But turning the aspirational things into operational things, I was introduced here to the work of an American academic called Richard Addison, where he has this concept of backward mapping, that the exercise of setting goals is a forward mapping thing. Where are we going to get to in so many years' time? What are the signposts, indicators, benchmarks, studied, are the usual terminology? He says, no. If you're going, you can do that, that's okay, but better, more effective is to go to the most basic level of implementation. If we're talking about education, you go to the teachers, for example, and the parents in the community and say, if we bring in this innovation, this change, whether it's something like an accelerated learning program in West Africa or a change in the curriculum or a new approach to textbooks, you go to the lowest level of implementation and say to the people there, what opportunities would this create for you and what problems would it create for you? Then out of that feedback, you make the plan. So you build it from the bottom upwards. And I think that though what Olaf has said is correct, that there are these further signposts and implementation issues, unless you can get to grips with what actually happens in the classroom in some way, and helping governments to clarify how they're dealing with that, then you won't make the progress that you want. I'm reminded of a quotation. Once upon a time, there was a country called Yugoslavia, and I met an educator from there. I can't even remember his name. It was so long ago. I was saying to somebody, I'm nearer my 90th birthday than my 60th. That's frightening, isn't it? But anyway, he said that he was worried about schooling, formal schooling. And he said, formal schools are like a hospital which tends to the healthy and rejects the sick. If you think about that, that's what we do in schools if we're not careful. All the time you're passing the tests and so on, you can stay. The moment you fail a test, goodbye. And until we get to change that around, and this is what inclusivity would mean for me, or one aspect of it, what happens in the classroom? How do you change that? We did some research in Zambia, and also when I worked in South Africa. A major problem we found was that teachers simply did not turn up to teach. So it wasn't a question only of what Anders was talking about, that their command of the curriculum and of literacy generally was limited, but they didn't even rock up at the school to pass on what they did know to the children. So dealing with what happens at the classroom level to turn that aspirational goal into something operational, that's the biggest challenge for me.
I think you've been mentioning part of what will be my second question. There is this, Kjetil, you've been talking about the shift from just access to quality. But I wonder, how can we actually understand quality? What does quality in the SDGs stand for? Do you have some answers to that?
Can I respond to that initially? The standard cliche type. Sorry.
Oh, no, sorry.
I didn't hear your name mentioned.
I think I got the question, didn't I?
Okay, carry on, please. No.
In Save the Children, of course, we think a lot about quality, and we have made our quality framework, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that in this framework the child is in the middle. The child's well-being and the child's learning, be it literacy, numeracy. So if you see the child in the middle, we saw a nice adieu here. You can see her in the middle. So what needs to be, according to Save the Children, what needs to be in place for her to feel well and happy and safe and learn? We see there are five foundations that support the learning environment. Do you want to know the five? Should I tell you the five? Yeah, okay. So we have the emotional and psychological protection. That could be positive and respectful interaction. For instance, that the teacher doesn't hit adieu. It could be social and emotional learning. We have the physical protection, so that the school is safe and an accessible learning space, so you're not bullied by soldiers on your way to school, or the school building doesn't collapse in your head. That there is water. You'd be surprised at how many schools have no water and have no toilets for their children. Health and nutrition is coming up as a huge issue. You are hungry. How can you learn? And, of course, school safety management. Then we have the teaching and learning. Of course, we talk about teachers, that they need to be qualified, but they also need to... There's also the teacher's well-being. They may be traumatized. Look, teachers in Syria, how difficult is it not for them to teach? Or that there is a professional development plan for them. That there is teaching and learning materials. I don't know how many schools I've been to where there is maybe one book in the classroom, and that is the teacher's book. Language for learning. We all know what research says. I just had this discussion with my colleagues in Rumbek, about teaching in the local their language, which is Dinka. The parents don't want it. They do not want it because they see the ones who have RSXS, they are the ones who master English. So what do you do? The pedagogical practice, and of course planning, assessment, and all that. We have another factor is the parents. In we work in many conflict countries where there are no systems in place, and there you really see how important the parents and the community is. There is their school, and so the parent and teachers associations is a strong, and we really see their importance, and that parents participate. It's something we just take for granted in Norway, but that is not the case in many other countries we are working. We have one more, and which is. Okay, yeah, school leadership and management, so that there are inclusive and protective policies, and a proper school management that knows what they're supposed to be doing. And around that, of course, is all policies, for instance, gender policies, policies on inclusive education and of course access to school. So these three circles. This is how we see and how we work on quality.
Okay,
it's
thank
here.
You. I think that both of you wanted to start, so I leave it up to you.
You first this time.
Okay. And again, I do apologize. I didn't hear your name mentioned. But anyway. I think, the standard definition of quality in education is fit for purpose. Is the schooling offered fit for purpose? But that raises the question, what is the purpose? And I think you've given a very comprehensive a breakdown of how that purpose can be isolated and identified. And oddly enough, what you just spelled out is more or less the pattern that the school inspectorate in Wales, where I'm living, uses for its school inspections. If the school is functioning properly, and it will conform to standards just like those that you've indicated. So if we go back to that issue of fit for purpose, I've never been satisfied with that myself, because I think a quality school goes beyond that. If we think about this institution we're sitting in now, the purpose is to educate people to a high level, to the master's and now even to the doctoral level. But then you're entitled to ask, so what? What happens to those people? What do they do? What do they become? How do they affect the world in which they live? So you've got to go beyond that simple cliche that it's a higher education institution, so it provides higher education, QED, all done and finished. But you've got to go beyond that, and I think the same thing applies to any form of schooling. What we've had in the past for so many, many years, and I know colonialism is blamed for many of these things. Incidentally, I once arrived in Zambia with a Norwegian colleague at the airport in Lusaka, and in those days you could get your visa for admission on payment of a fee when you arrived. And my Norwegian colleague handed over his Norwegian passport and was charged $25 for his visa. I handed over my British passport and was charged $47 for my visa. So I said to this very nice young woman behind the counter, what's going on? This Norwegian gets into your country for $25. I, a former colonial master, am charged 47. And she said, that is why you are charged 47. Which I thought was very cute. Yeah, the issue about the impact of colonialism, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this concept from Bourdieu of the habitus, the mindset, the way you look at the world, very much affected by the way in which you are educated, and it may separate you from your life and your culture, or it may integrate you, and it's what Anders has been talking about for quite a while. So I think fitness for purpose, and the main purpose there is to see that you are not out of place in the environment where that you are, but it goes beyond that. You have something to contribute. You have something for development, for making things different, i.e. better. So let's just go beyond that rather mundane thing of fit for purpose and go beyond that. The quality thing means much more than that, that purpose is fulfilled, but it leads on to further things. That's my view of it.
I might have a slightly more theoretical answer, because I wouldn't dare to define what is quality. And that comes out of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where it's stated that it's the obligation of every country to provide education of good quality to children and youth. And it also says that it's up to the parents to decide what sort of education their children will have, which opens up for very different sorts of interpretations. But I think it is the obligation of also of the country to define what is quality. And I think this has to be seen in the context of the national situation. I think there's growing awareness that education should provide youth with the skills that enables them to sort of enter adult life, and particularly sort of a transition to work. I think that's critical for everybody. We used to have quite a big discussion in UNESCO also about what is quality, and it was quite interesting, because I was told that the Norwegian system is not high quality. It's not on top in terms of PISA and things like that. And then I started talking to Chinese and colleagues from China and South Korea, and they said, "Oh, you have the best system in the world. Are we missing out?" And this really comes down to some of what these new skills that are defined as 21st century skills, which is more into tolerance, cooperation, innovation, entrepreneurship, and things like that. So this, in a way, illustrates how complicated quality is. And I would say that I'm proud to be Norwegian, because I think in terms of inclusion and quality, no countries beat the Nordics. I'm sorry, even you are a colonial master, but I think the Nordics have something to teach to the rest of the world.
Sorry, can I just quickly say something about that? Because not to defend colonialism or anything like that, but research from the university in Hong Kong shows that those Chinese students who come out top of the PISA rankings time after time are at school from 7:30 or 8 in the morning until 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night very frequently. They go to a cramming school after the and they wind up with a lifelong hatred of the subjects that they've been studying. So that's another quality issue.
I have two more questions, but as we also want to have some time for questions from you, I think I'm going to ask them at the same time, and you can choose yourself if you want to answer both or just one of them. So question number three is, how do you implement the new education goal in your organization? How do you work with the new SDG? And then my final question would be, do we have reason to believe that these goals will actually be more sustainable than the previous educational goals? Will we have ensured inclusive and equitable quality education and lifelong learning opportunities for all in 2030?
I think just on what we're doing in Norway at the moment in terms of sort of following up on the SDGs. It's a big debate at the moment to see how you really can ensure inclusive education that includes everybody. And this proves to be very, very complicated and taking a lot of resources, because I think so far there's been a lot of focus on sort of providing education opportunities to everybody through sort of general education systems. And we know that you won't reach the hard to reach by sort of providing general education opportunities. You also need some targeted approaches. And I think this is particularly where civil society is maybe better placed than the official school system too. But on our part, we've also been focusing a lot on teachers and teacher issues, because I think this is the most critical bottleneck you find, because in many countries, teacher issues are so political. And as Bob said, that teachers were not showing up at school. That's okay, but that's understandable when they are not paid. So it's very complicated, but we've been working with all the relevant multilateral institutions and also Education International and ILO to start a new program to really support some countries in developing comprehensive teacher policy, which also opens up for social dialogue, because we really need to engage the whole community if you're going to sort of try to bundle some of these bottlenecks that you see at the national level. But I think there's been a great progress also on the teacher side, because traditionally teacher unions can be seen as quite conservative and even regressive, but I think teachers are now realizing that there's a lot on focus on ethical standards of teachers. So I've seen a big change in the attitudes of the party. So hopefully there can be some progress. And of course, the other element we can do something about is reading material. And I totally agree that there's a total lack of quality reading materials. So we work closely with USAID on setting up a book alliance. And we have been particularly active in something very exciting, bringing new technology, setting up a digital library, which will make quality teaching material available, also to be translated into local languages free of charge. So I think at least if we manage to do something radical with teachers and learning material, I think we're on the way.
Of course, we are fully very well aware of that the Sustainable Development Goals are extremely ambitious and something to strive for, and Save the Children, we find them very challenging, and also when it comes to education and inclusion and leaving no one behind. So, is there a political will to do so? To include the most marginalized, it's much more costly. So if I come to you and say I can reach, with the 15 million you give me, I can reach maybe 500 way out in somewhere, or I can reach not so marginalized children, many more. So this is difficult. And sustainability depends on financing. And not primarily aid. I think it was the World Bank report that, where it says that 90% of what is needed for education must come from national budgets. And I sometimes wished I worked in the Minister of Finance and was not dealing with the Minister of Education, because it's the Minister of Finance. This is where you should go. They're the ones that hold the key. And our colleague in NORAD, Director General Jon Lomøy, he says that education is spelled T-A-X or S-K-A-T-T in Norwegian. So, and I'm looking at you again. And so one of the most important things that Norway, as a donor, the donor is here, can do, and as an OECD country, is to support countries in building up their tax systems and take a proactive role in stopping the flow of capital out of the developing countries. But here, this is not only developing countries, because I don't know if you read Aftenposten yesterday and you heard about the Paradise Papers. Here it says, the Norwegian tax flow of tax out of the country could pay for 31,600 teachers a year. And this is Norway. Financing is key, of course.
And do you want to say more? Or because Olaf wanted to comment, and then.
Well, just because we had an internal discussion, and I told, tax in itself is not a solution if it's not linked to justice in some way, because usually in many countries, still education system serves the elite and not the underprivileged. So countries might decide to spend more money on higher education, which serves the interest of the elite. So it's a bit more complicated.
Like to answer in I don't have an organisation. My wife wouldn't respond to that at all. neither would the dog. But I'd like to respond at two levels. First of all, to defend the big organisations a little, not too much. UNESCO, UNICEF, the bank, and so on. What they do is push the agenda. Ministers of education go home from conferences in Paris or Washington or whatnot, and they may well go back with some fresh ideas, feel that they've got to, if that's the right word, compete with what other governments are doing, and ask why are we being left behind. So I think there is a role for the big organizations to push the agenda and to keep the issues at the forefront of things. At the other extreme, I was talking to Maren earlier about the brief experience of mine in West Africa, which she knows more about than I do. And that was some work I was doing with the Stroma Foundation, looking at what they were doing with communities, reflecting what Olaf was saying earlier. See, I pinch other people's ideas all the time. And what they were doing in these small communities were microcredit programs run by women very effectively. And there are many, many stories about how they use these very small loans from a microcredit organization in the community. And linked with that were what they called speed schools, which were accelerated learning programs. Kids who couldn't get to school or dropped out of school or so on were given a crash course with a local teacher, lots of support and encouragement, and then they were funneled back into the formal system. So you have these two things going on at the same time. And this relates to this prosperity without growth issue. But these communities were getting a certain level of prosperity. They weren't about to be floated on the stock exchange, but there were things going on, and people were earning money and using it to send their children to school or for other worthwhile purposes. And then the women in these communities said to me, we need a third leg for this little stool or pot to stand on. And I said, and what is that? And they said, we want to be literate. We're managing our own affairs, we're keeping books and accounts and so on, but we want to read and write. If we had that capacity allied to these other things, then reflecting what Anders was talking about earlier, the whole profile of the community rises. So what you need are the two, at least these two levels, and all sorts of stuff going on in between. The big agencies pushing the agenda, and then local, community-based, NGO-based, activities which make a difference to particular communities. Then you can get your goals sustainable, I think.
Okay. thank you very, very much for giving us some answers, your answers, and maybe also giving us some food for thought. I'm going to borrow my microphone to everyone, anyone who has a question for our three panelists. Are there any questions in the audience? Or comments, maybe? Ellen first.
Thank you, all three of you, talking about inclusion. I was just browsing through, in brief, some of those 10 goals again under SDG 4. Thinking, could we go further when it comes to inclusion and then also think about epistemologies? As far as I've heard from you, it's kind of including more and more people at different levels. But what about the inclusion of a wider epistemological kind of base also for the schooling and the education and whatever learning? Just wanting to hear your reflections on that.
What about we take a second question and then you answer both of them? Is that fine?
Thank you so much. Olav, I think you mentioned something very, very good about the SDGs, about the universality. I just wanted to know where, at which level are you talking about the universality of the project? Because for me, I think when we talk about universality, that is where the problem is. For me, it's quite problematic, depending, of course, on the level that you are looking at it from. Because like when you look at the African context, I think if we have to continue doing what the MDGs did by using the one-size-fits-all concept, I think it will never work. We need to start appreciating the contextual realities on the ground that should be related to that universality that you are talking about. So I just wanted you to comment on the universality. At what level is it that you are looking at it? Thank you.
I think these two questions are a bit related, actually, because my concern is, I think starting with your question, I think universality applies to every level, from the local to the national and global. And my concern is that this goals and targets are getting so ambitious and complicated, and so trying to include everything that they get more to be a sort of disengagement and a guidance in the process. I say this because when I was in UNESCO, I was fortunate to become involved in the process that was run by Africans, and I was the only non-African in the room, which was, for me, a big learning process, because what I heard from permanent secretaries in the ministry is that they were really struggling with these goals because they were not seen as relevant to their national and local context. And they said directly that this is something that's developed by UN diplomats in New York who has no idea what is going on in the national scene or in the national context. So I'm not sure if sort of making it even more ambitious would help. My concern is that you, at every level, from the local to the district to the national level, bring in stronger accountability and more clarity in terms of what are the goals you set and what sort of monitoring mechanism there are in place in order to hold the players accountable in terms of delivering on the goals. But I think it's really up to the countries themselves to build ownership to these processes. This is something the donors can't help countries to build ownership. That has to come from the countries themselves. So I think that's something I really learned being engaged in this process, is that if it doesn't mean or seen as being seen as relevant from for the sort of players involved in this, it won't have much impact, I'm afraid.
Just on that issue of ownership, I think Norway, with many other donors, was engaged in a big program that Ellen mentioned in her presentation, and that was called BESIP, the Basic Education Subsector Improvement Program. Not exactly a punchy title, but it summarized what was going on. And actually, over that process, the bank, I think, was the lead agency there, but Norway, the Netherlands, the Brits, various other donors were engaged with that very big program. And what we did see over a 3 to 4 year period was a takeover of ownership by the Zambian technical people. That to begin with, everything was presented by the expats, by the foreigners and the experts. But we soon learned that local knowledge and local expertise was strong. And I think that has become an issue, a very positive one. Going back to the finance thing, I think we had figures from Birger Fredriksson a few years ago that over 90% of the finance for basic education in Africa comes from national governments themselves. They're not dependent upon overseas aid. And if a donor tries to manipulate things, many of these governments are in a position of saying, sorry, we actually don't need your cash. We've got pretty well enough to manage things in our own way, which is another dimension of ownership that we ought to encourage. But it does happen. Yeah. He wants to come back.
Okay, now the discussion is getting lively here, and I'm getting signals from Christine that we need to come to a close. We can. Wonderful. Then would you have liked to comment before? Okay.
No, just a comment to the last comment of Bob, because I share the same concern. I'm also the Norwegian representative of the Global Partnership for Education, and the transaction cost of some of these initiatives are very high. And talking to ministers, I hear that they are starting to question what's in it for us. Are we getting anything out of this? But there are some positive signs. I was in Dakar a couple of months ago on the sort of triennial meeting of the Association for the Development of Education in Africa, where I could hear a totally different voice from the African ministers and heads of state saying that we need to take responsibility ourselves. We can't continue to blame others. We have to deliver. So something is happening.
So maybe I could just add on the experience from South Sudan during the period from when the peace agreement was signed and until independence, donors set up a fund called Multi-Donor Trust Fund, and I don't remember exactly the figures, but money from the donors, but also from the South Sudanese government. And there was a huge pushback from the South Sudanese authorities for letting various NGOs implement the program. So nothing got off the ground for years, because there was this big debate on who should take the lead here. So it's good in a way, of course, to take ownership, but the capacity to do so, to implement, also has to be in place.
Okay, I don't think you really answered Ellen's question.
No, not yet. Don't be so impatient.
because I think it's an extremely important question, and it may complicate matters, but it also may improve matters. And there is now a big group of African scholars working on indigenous knowledges and how it should be included in the curriculum, et cetera, et cetera. And I have a PhD student, Maren, actually, who's looking into this from a South African perspective in science education. So this should not be overlooked by NORAD or the foreign ministry. It's extremely important, because the alienation for the majority of the students in primary and secondary school is so huge that learning is almost nil, as I showed in one of the slides. Yeah.
Okay, now we have minus 1 minute to answer that.
I just want to refer to this big program that we are running in Nepal. And actually, our colleagues at Tribhuvan University, as well as Kathmandu University, they are very much aware of protecting and including their own epistemological and cultural knowledge and values at master level, targeting teachers at both universities, face-to-face as well as online. So that's a good, really good sign. And it's not necessarily, it's not me pushing it, because it comes from the Nepalese professionals themselves. Thank you.
Well, so excuse me, Ellen, for not really properly answering your question, but being outside the academic world and you say epistemology, I just, oh my God, you, what is this? So please come and educate us. We invite you, please.
I totally agree on the value of indigenous skills. One of the most interesting discussions I ever had was I was sitting in a meeting with the Minister of Education from India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And we just sort of discussed what is quality in education. And they were saying that if you sort of only assess sort of reading and writing as quality education, then you're in for trouble, because you have children coming from indigenous communities who might have other skills that are very developed, like handcraft and things like that. And these are often children who are really suffering to master the sort of ordinary curricula. So you have to be very careful in sort of defining what is quality, and also recognize the importance of these indigenous skills.
I talked to an American missionary who'd spent many years in Zambia, and he told me how he had gone to attend the funeral of a church elder in Zambia, and was talking about how sad it was that their brother had passed on, talking to another church elder. And the living church elder said to him, well, of course, witchcraft was involved. And the missionary said, what? But you know, he was in the hospital, he was suffering from malaria, and malaria is passed on by a certain mosquito, Anopheles mosquito. He was infected, and he died. How can you say that witchcraft was involved? And the elder said, but you have not explained why the mosquito chose to bite him and not somebody else. So we can smile at a story like this, but this is a local epistemology, a local way of knowing what we know. And we have to respect that, understand it, and try to incorporate those sorts of issues into the way we deal with learning and teaching. It's valid. It's what people's life world is all about, and we need to know that.
Well, now that Anders has given away what I do my PhD on, I would actually like to keep you here for 3 hours and ask you much more questions. But what I'm going to do instead is to give you some flowers and to say thank you very, very much for coming.
I'm here to close the program. Ellen, Anders, Maren, Merete, would you please stand up here with me for just a minute? Okay, the camera is turned to you. Okay. So everyone, thank you so much for being here today to help us celebrate our anniversary. Okay.
Ellen says we'll give you
an applause.
There are pictures here from our students up on the wall that you may look at afterwards. And we have some refreshments and time for talk after leaving this room. But I just, before leaving today, I just want to say that I found this a very interesting day. I think it's very good to have these days to be able to reflect back and to sort of try to bring things together and to think about the future. And I need to say a few words of thank you to my colleagues, those of us who are here. Of course, there have been many more people involved. I should ask Haldis to come up here as well, because you have been... Haldis? No, okay. There have been many more people involved in developments and teaching, supervision, and so on and so forth throughout the years, obviously. But we are the ones who are here now. And Maren... Ellen, Anders, and Merete have worked really hard to make this day happen, to put this program together, to find people to, to find everyone to invite, to collect stories from students, to spread the word, and so on and so forth.
You as well? Not much.
Ellen has been with the program since before it started. And is still so engaged in everything that we are doing. And she helped get this off the ground. And I am very, very happy that we've been working together for all these years. Anders,
we're not done.
Anders, we're also not done.
But for today,
we're done. Merete, Maren, Sandra, I should mention Sandra as well, but she had to leave earlier, the third PhD student. Merete and Maren and Sandra, you are taking this to the future. So we're very happy that you are with us and working with us now, and we're looking forward to the continuation. So thank you very much. And I hope you can join us for some small talk and, everything that we haven't been able to share in the breaks and all of that stuff. So by this, I'm closing the program, and we'll see you out in the lobby. Thank you.